you just came in over the last minute or two, we are in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. We will technically start today in chapter 12, but more on that in a minute. We are in the middle of a series called God in the Mess, and this is actually the continuation of a series we started last summer. We ended with chapter 11 last summer and then picked off where we left off 2 weeks ago in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Now we've moved on to 13. Just a quick observation. One of the reasons for the title, the idea behind the series, is that Corinth, in terms of that day, as far as a church, was quite a mess. There was a lot of things going on. There was a lot of contention within the church. And I've mentioned that several times, both last summer and this summer. The one thing that I think I am more in tune with than I was last summer is that when we talk about 1 Corinthians, we're not just talking about the mess at Corinth, we're talking about our mess. The church today, even if it's not individual churches, just totality, the church is a mess. And there's just a lot in this text, not just for us at City View Church, but just for the wider church. And some of it will be more, it'll hit home more for some of us. And some of it will just hit home in the larger church culture. But whatever you think of the messages that are being relayed in this text and how they relate to you and our larger church, I just want you to understand that these are very timely messages for us to hear. And so with that, I want to just do some quick catch up on 1 Corinthians. If you did not know this about it, if you did not have any time with us in 1 Corinthians prior, in 1 Corinthians we notice within the text that factions of some sort have developed within this church. He said, she said, I do, you do. There's a lot of disagreement. People are asking questions in this text based upon a lot of the things that they have some disagreements on. And some are actually asking Paul questions to get him to side with them against others they disagree with. Now, Paul, for his part, if it's not clear, let me make it clear, Paul is interested in actually helping them reconcile rather than helping reinforce their sides. He wants them to reconcile and come together and be a united people of Jesus within Corinth. And today's text is very much a continuation of what was addressed 2 weeks ago in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. And if I could just summarize, chapter 12 basically made the case that Christian spirituality, to be a spiritual person, to be a spirit-filled person, is not about what you do. It's not about what you can do or what you bring to the table, how gifted you are, how not gifted you are. Rather, being a spiritual person in Christian terms is primarily about having trusted Jesus. And he makes that clear right from the beginning of chapter 12. He says only someone who the Spirit is enabled can actually cry out that Jesus is Lord. Having confessed him as Lord, people who have trusted Jesus are by definition spiritual people. Anything else that we can qualify as a spiritual person, being a Christian, is merely an extrapolation of the fact that you or I have trusted Jesus as our leader and forgiver. It doesn't mean that it isn't spiritual that we exercise gifts. It doesn't mean that we can't be spiritual in other ways. It simply means that whatever ways that we exert our spirituality, it has to be funneled from, have its source in, us having trusted Christ and his Holy Spirit having taken up residence in our life. Now, in contrast from what we can make of the content in chapter 12, the Corinthians were having some disagreement on what actually defined Christian spirituality based on whether they were gifted in very specific ways. And from what we can determine based on the text, there were some at Corinth that thought that you had to have the ability to speak in various tongues to be truly a spiritual Christian, while others who didn't believe that reacted or responded to the tongue speakers by getting angry with the tongue speakers, by getting envious with the tongue speakers, and by pulling back from the local church and being dismissive of those that spoke in tongues. You see, so you can react to a wrong thing with a wrong response. In other words, it was a wrong response for them to be dismissive of legitimate spiritual gifts of speaking in tongues, but at the same time, they did have a point in that that is not what defines a person as a spiritual person. Okay, so there's a little bit going on all sides of the issue here in Corinth. So in chapter 12, after saying plainly that trusting Jesus and what Jesus did for us on the cross is what makes a person a spiritual person, the Apostle Paul then says that gifts, while not defining our level of spirituality, gifts are a part of God's further gifts of grace to you and to me, except that they come with conditions. They're gifts of grace, but the gifts of grace that have very specific things attached to them. For one, they are not exclusively things with which we are born. They are not exclusively things which with we have acquired skills. They are not specifically or only things with which we are even divinely charged to execute. In fact, it's all of the above. It's all of the above. And so part of understanding the condition of a gift is not to put stipulations on gifts or to put boundaries on gifts that the Bible doesn't put on gifts. And so the Bible has talked about gifts not only in these passages but elsewhere in very broad terms. They can be talents, they can be giftings that are divinely in charge, they can also be skill sets that we have acquired. Gifts are a part of God's further grace to us, and they are also considered something ordinary in some cases, and in other cases they can be referred to as what we consider fantastical. And so a condition of understanding God's gifts of grace is understanding that you are not allowed to put boundaries on it, and you are not allowed to determine what they are and the scope of what they are. The scriptures give us that. And so they are all these things, and both ordinary and fantastical. The second thing that we might want to mention in regards to gifts and their conditions is that whatever the gift I might bring to the table, whatever I bring to the table, it was always meant for me to bring to the table and to deliver for the common good. It's not for my self-promotion, not for my self-esteem, or even for my enjoyment, or for me to somehow feel like I am releasing my passions. That is not the purpose of spiritual gifts. You see, in the economy of the gospel of grace, anything that I bring to the table is primarily, not exclusively, but primarily meant for the common good. More on that in a minute. And what I mean by primarily and not exclusively is that primarily that's what they are made for. But spiritual gifts can give you and I a benefit to ourselves. It's just that is not its lead foot. That is not where it comes from. It comes from a sense of having been executed on the common good. Last thing I want to mention in terms of conditions. Our gifts are a means of uniting us. They were always meant as a means of uniting us in our diversity. And I want to talk about this word diversity and how the scriptures in our text uses it. I'm not talking about it in terms we use a lot in today's culture, like racial diversity or maybe socioeconomic diversity or whatever way we tend to use it in our culture. That's not really what I'm talking about. I'm talking about uniting us in our diversity of how we're made up, how we all bring to the table different skills, different talents, different divinely charged giftings. And it is in that that we are to actually see, by seeking the common good, find some sort of divine unity amongst ourselves. If if any gift that we bring to the table, any skill set we bring to the table, any kind of talent we were born with, somehow ends up dividing us instead of uniting us, we're doing gifts wrong. And that's part of what the scripture wants us to understand. And that's where we left off last week. We did not read the last verse of chapter 12, and that was intentional because it truly transitions us from the thoughts behind chapter 12 and what's to come in chapter 13. So let's read it, and we're going to go ahead and retrace our steps just to get a full scope all the way back to verse 27 of chapter 12. Now, you are the body of Christ, and individual members of it. He's just there told us we are a plurality and an individuality. We're both, okay? We're not one or the other. We're not more of one or the other. We're both. We're individuals, but we're also a collective body of Jesus meant to be united as a one together in a plurality. And God has appointed these in the church, first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, next miracles, then gifts of healing, helping, administrating, various types of tongues. He's not meaning to put these in order so much as he's just creating a list for us, and it's not exhaustive by any stretch. He's just giving a list that's somewhat representative. And then he continues on in response to this, asking a set of questions that are meant to imply a no answer. Are all people apostles? No. Are all prophets? No. Are all teachers? No. Do all do miracles? No. Do all give gifts of healing? No. Do all speak in other tongues? No. Do all interpret? No. And this is where we really get into the transition. But, he says, desire the greater gifts. Whoa! Didn't he just make the case there is no such thing as greater gifts? We'll get to that in a minute. Then he finishes off saying, I will show you an even better way. Okay, so real quickly before we jump into 13, we have two options on this first sentence we have, desire the greater gifts. The first is to take it as an indicative. If you're not familiar with what an indicative it is, it's basically saying, this is what you are doing. This is what you are doing. You are desiring the greater gifts. In fact, we actually have a few translations that translate it that way. That's making a decision, though, on how we're to interpret it. You are desiring the greater gifts. The truth is that mostly any kind of reputable lexical study will tell you it is just not likely. It is a hard, hard stretch to make it an indicative, to actually say that what it's saying is that you are desiring the greater gifts, and that's a bad thing. I'm going to show you a better way. Okay? So it's not likely that's what it's saying. So the other option is to take it as it's translated in the CBD as an imperative, saying, you go and desire those greater gifts. You go and you do this. Now, here's the thing to understand about this. This is not speaking necessarily qualitatively. In fact, I would say contextually, it is impossible to interpret it that way, to say that it's speaking qualitatively. In other words, there is not a set of greater gifts in all times, in all places, for all people that always is true. Because he just made the case over a chapter that doesn't exist. And so he's not speaking qualitatively, but he's still urging them to desire the greater gifts. So what can he mean? Except for desire the greater gifts amongst you in your church, in this time, in this place, in your circumstances that you need. In other words, take a look around, determine what you need, and desire what your church needs. Okay? And so that's what he means by greater. It's like, what's the greater gift? In your situation. And by the way, he'll actually make a judgment call on their situation. What is the greater gift in their situation? We'll get to that in chapter 14 in just a little bit, but we can't get there yet. That's in a few weeks. And so the second sentence on follow-up to desiring the greater gifts ends up being key to understand what he is doing. He says, I will show you an even better way. to desire the greater gifts, I'm going to show you a better way of doing that, getting to that, than the ways you have used to get to that thus far. There's a better way to go about finding the best and the common good, what is needed in your situation, than simply using your gut or using your best value judgment or deductive reasoning or simply making decisions based upon what you bring to the table, what you can do, or versus what is actually needed. And so Paul is going to help the Corinthians, he's going to help them understand. And by the way, not just the Corinthians, he's going to help us understand how to determine the common good or how to get to the common good and the greater gift for our church and our circumstances. So let's find out, starting in verse 1. If I speak human or angelic tongues, but do not have love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so that I can move mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. And if I give away all my possessions, and if I give over my body in order to boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. So just stopping there, to the degree that you and I are actually engaged in the act of attempting to love one another, if we're to take this text for what it's saying, we actually, in loving one another, are setting ourselves on a good course to know what is needed for the common good. That's really what this is getting at. And said another way, love precedes our very ability to determine the common good. In other words, if I don't truly seek to really love other people in my midst, in my church, in my neighborhood, my tendency, my bias, my knee-jerk reaction, because I still have sin within me, is to use other people. That's my tendency. And so I'll look to use any gifts, any skills, any talents I possess in a way that indulges me, satisfies me, interests me. If you did not know this about yourself, this is actually a part of what we still struggle with the sin inside of us. And we don't necessarily do this maliciously. We don't like scheme out a plan as to how to use people. That's usually not the way it works. It's just something that's a part of us, that's creeping in inside of us, that's not surrendered to God, the Holy Spirit in us, that wants to change us, that desires to use people in some way. But to love other people as my lead foot, that's different. That sets my desire on what's best for and blesses others. Let me give you just a quick example from just everyday life that I think we all can relate to. I don't mean to project this on everyone here. Maybe this is just my issue, but how we love each other, how we love other people in our simple conversations with other people versus loving ourselves in simple conversations with others. For example, person is speaking to me. I'm listening. And while I'm listening, let's see if this ever happens to you, I'm waiting to share something I want to share. Maybe something about myself. Something about my kids, because my kids are attached to me. Using the conversation effectively and the subject matter of the conversation effectively as a vehicle to say something I want to get out, to brag, to promote myself, rather than to actually talk and hear another person. So out of curiosity, do you ever get super excited when you're kind of outside of a conversation, you hear something that piques your ears, that interests you, some subject matter that you know you have something to bring to the table on? And in that, you see an opportunity or opening to share some information that serves your ego or esteem in some way. Ever do that? I do this way too often. It makes me uncomfortable. But if it doesn't, that's what I'm talking about. It's an example of the difference between loving people in a conversation versus using people my conversation with you is simply a conduit by which I can get out something that reminds you of how awesome I am, or how awesome my kids are, which in turn tells you how awesome my parenting skills are. You get what I'm saying, you know? This is what we do. A lot of people do it, some more obvious than others, some are real slick about hiding it, but we do this nonetheless. In these texts, Paul is showing us a way of life, the way of life that precedes and equips us to seek and use gifts for the common good and not simply for some twisted sense of self-satisfaction or self-fulfillment. Look at what he's saying to them. He's saying that if I don't have love, I'm a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I don't have love, even though I move mountains, I am nothing. Not that I do nothing, I am nothing. I'm acting in an identity that is nothingness. I'm a nobody. But do not have love, I gain nothing. Even if I'm generous, even if I give away everything, even my body. Now, what you need to understand about this is that he is telling this group of people at Corinth, a people that are incredibly wealthy in terms of their giftedness and talent. Apparently they were just ripe with all kinds of gifted, resource-rich people at Corinth. And he's telling them that if they use their gifts and talents without love being their lead foot, they are essentially an empty, meaningless gong, that they are nothing. And that, by the way, they don't actually gain anything. They're spinning their wheels. That's some pretty significant words, especially to a group of people that probably understood that they were talent and skill and gifted rich as a people. And to be clear, he's not subtly criticizing any particular gift in this particular chapter. He's plainly addressing the lack of love in the discharging of people's giftedness. For instance, a person can be incredibly generous, he says, even to the point where they not only give away all that they have, all their resources, all their finances, but they give away their very body. But yet they, in some way, if they're not being very loving, they're not actually being very generous. I think about this, and I hope this doesn't come off the wrong way, but in my world, and I say in my world, the world I run in terms of just pastors and churches and leaders of churches, first service I called it a love-hate. Maybe that's too strong. I have a love-frustration relationship with large churches and the megachurch. The love I have is that I've been a part of several, and the people, some of the most fantastic people I know are pastors and leaders in very large churches. They tend to be very generous churches overall. But here's where this kind of goes awry. I have encountered more frustration, especially in the area of generosity, than anything, because a lot of the large churches I interact with want to give you things that you didn't ask for. And I'm always wondering, so why am I being given this and supposed to be thankful for it? I didn't really ask for this, and I don't want it. Years ago, one particular pastor, not of a church that we're really affiliated with, he actually gave away all of his sermons, all of his sermon graphics and whatnot, and some videos and some other research and whatnot. They called them campaigns and said, hey, this is free for anyone to take. And what was so interesting about that is not very many pastors, including myself, really responded to that. Didn't really say anything about it. Didn't say anything negative, just didn't say anything. And at one moment in time, I heard him speaking in a public way and muttering a little bit about the fact that he just couldn't believe there was a lack of gratitude for the resources they provide and whatnot. And anyway, I just found that very off-putting, because I just thought, I didn't want that from you. You know, like I love my people, and I want my people to be understanding that I'm actually thinking about them. I like crafting sermons. I like thinking through what our people need to hear. I'm not just looking to have a package that's handed to me and that I give out. But it was interpreted as ingratitude, but it's not. And we definitely don't want to fester ingratitude, but we definitely want to understand how we might sometimes let people feel the weight of ourselves, our gifts, our resources, our talents, our skills, when they didn't ask for it. To love someone is actually to care what they need, to care what they may want. Now, it doesn't mean we indulge people in all they want. Sometimes what they want isn't what they need. But, again, that also requires love to determine what people actually want, what they need, even if it's not what they want. So to be clear, dismissing a person or organization's generosity is not always an evidence of a lack of gratitude. And some of us are thankful for things we're not really thankful for. Maybe it's an opportunity to talk about what you really desire or what you really want instead of pretending you're thankful for something. In fact, I'm reading through this and I'm just thinking, man, even sharing the gospel, which is the best news on the planet, right? Sharing the gospel. I mean, what could ever be bad about sharing the gospel with anyone for any reason ever? Well, if you do it without a sense of love, I have a sense that a lot of things usually go awry in doing that. Yeah, I think sharing the gospel also without love creates a lot of problems. To do so is getting things horribly out of order, according to this text, and usually an act of duty, maybe even fear, or maybe self-justification. The list could go on, but don't miss the fact that he's making a case that true, genuine love for other people should drive the way we think and talk to them about anything, okay? But if we try to skip the act of actually loving them, things usually go awry. So often when love is absent in the use of gifts, skills, resources, it often only breeds and intensifies already existing senses of inferiority and superiority in people. And so we see that here. The abuse and the lack of love in this church has caused one group to feel superior and make sure the other group knows they're superior, and one group to feel inferior to the point of being envious and wanting to pull back from the local church. So we see this playing itself out. Look at verse 4. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love does not envy. It's not boastful. It's not arrogant. It's not rude. It's not self-seeking. It's not irritable and does not keep a record of wrongs. Love finds no joy in unrighteousness, but rather rejoices in the truth. It bears all things. It believes all things. It hopes all things. It endures all things. Now, in these passages, which if you are familiar with the Bible at all, chances are you have heard these passages many times quoted. Oftentimes, it's on pieces of papers at weddings reminding us that this is an occasion of love, and here's what love looks like. It's read by many people on occasions where love is the subject. But in this passage, love is not so much being defined as it is being described. It's being described. These verses are thick with behavioral language, reminding us that love is most often understood and expressed and felt by others in terms of our thoughts, words, and actions. We need to understand that. It's a very practical thing, love. It's not this ethereal kind of I can't grab pie in the sky concept. Love is very grounded. It's very practical. It's very hands-on. It's something that people should feel. He starts off by saying love is patient. If you know me long enough, you know I've talked about this passage many times, and I'd like to remind people that it's not just patient as in it's tapping its toe, waiting on other people. This is actually what we would call a long-suffering kind of patience. It stands its ground. It holds its ground. This even carries the idea of enduring or holding one's ground despite offenses, and without retaliation. At the church at Corinth, there were obviously people who were feeling the offenses, and as a result, they weren't standing their ground. They were withdrawing from the community of Jesus instead of holding their ground and actually moving away because of their offense. He says, that's not love. It's not love for them to act superior and tell you you're a nobody because you don't have the gift of speaking of tongues. It is also unloving that you're withdrawing for them for having done that. That is unloving as well. An unloving response to an unloving act. He goes on, love is kind. In other words, it's characterized by a knee-jerk reaction of kindness over having a knee-jerk reaction of hostility or maybe just plain indifference. And then it goes on to use some negatives. It's kind and certainly not envious, okay? Certainly not envious. We know that there was many who were being accused of being less spiritual people because they didn't talk in tongues. That they became envious of those who did because of their high position or high respect or high influence in the church at Corinth. And so they were envious. He says, love's not envious. That's not a good reaction to how they're acting towards you. It's not envious. It's not proud or puffed up or boastful. It's not rude. It's not rude. The idea behind this is not just rude as in how you understand rude. It's actually the idea of an improper relationship to the person you're not loving. That there is an actual improper relationship. In the scriptures, this is a word that's also used of those who try to stir another's affections without carrying through and marrying them. Okay? So that's kind of the idea, the broad idea behind the rudeness or improper relationship towards others. I had a local pastor who befriended me when we first started City View Church, and I could tell he wanted to be my mentor. Just to be plain with you, he was not the kind of guy I would ever want to be my mentor. He was nice enough, and I wanted some specific thoughts about the community from him, and I didn't mind hanging out with him. I didn't mind gaining some sort of knowledge of the community from him. But he wanted much more than that, and so he would give me what I want so as to somehow, in the exchange of the relationship, make me his mini-me, so to speak, as a pastor. And when I rebuffed that and when I did not do things that he clearly wanted me to do that were out of his personality and not my own, he went ballistic on me and pretty much, I won't go into the details. It was terrible, though. That's an improper relationship towards someone, trying to be something for someone that you can't be and not carrying through on what you've promised based upon what you want to get out of the situation. That's what it is to be rude. Not self-seeking, he says. He's already covered that subject several times already in the text. Not irritable. Not easily angered. Not easily offended. That's also what irritable means. Not easily offended. Love does not carry a record of wrongs. It's not about keeping score. You know what I'm talking about when I say keeping score? Do you have that with people in your lives? Like, oh sure, that was wrong, but you have way more wrongs in front of you than I have in front of me. And so I actually can do wrong to you several more times before we're even close in the score. That's keeping a record of wrongs, right? So we do this with one another. Do not file away grievances for another day for you to use. It's making someone into a pariah or maybe even focusing on all that's wrong about him or her. He goes on to say, truth is celebrated as opposed to unrighteousness. It's celebrated. It's not an inconvenience to be given the truth. It's not a negative truth if it does not benefit you in some way. And he's kind of setting them up at this point because he realizes his words, both in this chapter and the prior chapter and the chapter to come, these words of truth could very likely make them toss him off the edge of the boat and say, okay, we're done listening to you, Paul. He's saying to them, truth is good and should be celebrated even when it's inconvenient to your agenda. Even when it's inconvenient to what you are believing about a lie currently, even if it's not very beneficial to you, frankly, at the moment. It's also ready to help with needs. When he says bears all things, it's basically another way of saying it doesn't have a list of things I'll do and things I won't do. I will gladly help our church with counting the money. I will not do kids. I just don't do kids ministry. That is unloving. That is a I won't bear all things attitude. He's saying, hey, whatever is needed, you're willing to bear it. Whatever burdens are there, you're willing to meet it. Doesn't mean you're going to. Doesn't mean logistically it's even possible for you. But it means that were the situation right, my heart is willing to. I am willing to bear whatever burdens are before us. And I'm glad to do so. Love bears all things. It's biased towards trust. It's generous with the benefit of the doubt. It's not cynical. That's not its lead foot, at least. It's hopeful. It isn't crushed by prior disappointment. Again, it's not biased towards cynicism. It perseveres. It doesn't demand its rights and its personal freedoms. Love is willing to absorb some wrongs and some imperfections. It will persevere through those things. Now, what has just been said by the Apostle Paul is what has been described by author, scholar, and pastor D.A. Carson as altruistic love versus egotistical love. He has just given us a master's level course in Christian spirituality and what is birthed out of God's love for us, and that is altruistic love, not egotistical love. It continues in verse 8, love never ends. But as for prophecies, they will come to an end. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will come to an end. For we know in part and we prophesy in part currently, but when the perfect comes, the partial will come to an end. And when I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child, but when I became a man, I put childish things aside. For now, we only see a reflection as in a mirror, but then we're going to see differently. We're going to see face to face. Now I know in part, but then I will know fully, just as I am fully known. Now these three remain: faith, hope, love. But the greatest of these, which is interesting. That's an interesting phrase, right? Right after saying desire the greatest gifts, he says the greatest of these is love. Few quick explanations. The part or the partial in these texts is simply a reminder that everything in this world that we live in right now, even the most incredible gifts and resources, are ultimately imperfect, and they all have an expiration date. Every single one of them. I mean, think about it just in practical terms. You know this is true. The term, or the phrase, what have you done for me lately? Right? So that means people could do good things for you every day, but if you haven't done something for me lately, guess what? Everything good you've done for me is expired. We live by this rule in our society. We understand this intuitively, and it is true even with the best we have to offer. And so in the current state of things, you and I need one another in a way that this text says we will not need one another in the new heavens and the new earth. Praise be God, right? That is good news. In that sense, our giftedness now is needed because right now we are needy in this world. And so please don't hear in any of this some sort of diminishing of us using gifts. But they have a way in which they're to be used, and there's something that precedes them, and that is love. The perfect he's referring to is the state of affairs when you and I come face to face with Jesus, should we have trusted him with our lives. I will know fully the way I'm already fully known by Jesus. See, I don't know how I'm fully known by Jesus now. I only know a part of how I'm known by Jesus right now, but then, face to face, I will know fully, completely, how I am known by him. In other words, the redeemed heavens and earth are a place where God's people are freed from any misconceptions or any inability to understand or relate to God without hindrance. What a beautiful state that will be. No more doubt that he actually loves you. No more doubt that he actually wants your good. You're completely convinced of it in the new heavens and new earth in a way that we seem to falter in our commitment of that in this world. And finally, love is the greatest, he says. Why is that? Well, because it's foundational. It's foundational to everything. Even our ability to engage and exercise faith, our ability to enjoy and to have hope, has to be flowing from the conduit of love. The Bible already tells us this in other texts. John 3:16, which is one of the most famous texts, says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him will not perish and have everlasting life." That's a gospel, friends, right? The gospel itself is actually available to us. It actually came to us in the person and work of Jesus because God the Father loved us. Not because he had to, not just because our need of redemption, but because God the Father loved us. It reminds us that love is even the foundation for the gospel. In fact, love is not simply foundational as God's actions for us in Jesus, but love is foundational to God's very identity. Some of you have read this before, but later on in the Bible, in 1 John chapter 4, we have these words, God is love. It's attached to his actual identity. Like he loves us because that's a part of who he is. And the one who remains in love remains in God, and God remains in him. Think about this. Giftedness, talents, skills, those things can be duplicated by anyone. Resources and generosity can actually be executed by anyone. Even for what we would consider in today's world altruistic purposes. But love cannot be duplicated. At least not the kind of love that comes from and is given to us as a gift from God. I don't know if you are familiar with it, but in John chapter 13, we're given a rather blunt statement by Jesus. Verse 35, "By this everyone will know that you are my disciples." This is how they're going to know you're my disciples. If you love one another. Were I to believe the headline, the social media, the opinion of the day, I would think, this is how they will know you are my disciples. They are involved in this cause. They are involved in this ministry. All those things can be fine, but get the order right. That's not how they know people are Jesus' disciples. They know them, that they are Jesus' disciples by their love for one another. Anything else that is the result is the result. That they love one another. Don't miss what it says before in the sentence before in verse 34 either. It says, "I give you a new command, love one another just as I have loved you. You are also to love one another." The Apostle John actually expands on this a little in his letter in 1 John when he says, "Dear friends, let us love one another because love is from God, and everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. The one who does not love does not know God, because God is love. God's love was revealed among us in this way." This is how his love was manifest. "God sent his one and only Son into the world so that we might live through him." Love is from God as a gift to us. Not only what is it God's motivation to send us Jesus, but he is saying to us the practical or the practical way in which we experience God the Father's love for us is in Jesus, is in the Son of God. He is incarnate God's love for us. And he loved us not when we were lovely, but when we were unlovely. And here's the beauty of that. If that's the case, and we're to take his word seriously, that means because of the love that is given to us in the person and work of Jesus and how we have grafted him as the Lord and forgiver of our life, and we continue to submit to him, That means that the love that he was to us inhabits us via the Holy Spirit. That is the source for our love for one another. We cannot muster love for one another. We are wholly dependent to love the unlovely. And he says, do so because it was done for you. Let us do that in response to Jesus today.